Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and I'm really pleased to be able to zero in today with you on perennials. Perennials are kind of a favorite for me. I love perennials. They come up every year. They're beautiful if you get the right ones. You can have some problems with them from time to time, but I tell you what, if you had a copy of this book or could see it, Growing Perennials in Cold Climates, a lot of your questions would be answered. And we have two of the authors of that book with me today, at least by phone. Mike Hager, who owns Ambergate Gardens near Chaska, Minnesota. Ambergate Farms is a retail mail order walk-in business devoted entirely to herbaceous perennial flowers. Prior to opening his business, he worked for 15 years at the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. Mike Hager, welcome. Let's see. Are you there? Don't have him. Well, let's try again. Mike, are you there now?
I can hear you.
Okay, well, now I can hear you.
Good. Pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks a lot for joining us. With me as well today, Debbie Lani, who has worked professionally with plants and gardening for over 30 years. She works with Bailey Nurseries in Newport, Minnesota, near the Twin Cities. Her specialties are working primarily with the perennial and bedding plant crops, as well as roses and woody plants. Debbie, have I got you?
You do. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. And I also mentioned the other author is not with us today, John Whitman, but the three are the authors of Growing Perennials in Cold Climates. More than, over 2,000 varieties that are proven to thrive in cold climates. They've got some five-star ratings, some of the top-performing perennials are going to tell you about, new selections. One of the things I really like in the book is the chance to, the information that they have on the mail order, new mail order sources and other sources for the varieties of each plant, and especially those hard-to-get varieties. Hard to find varieties. They've got information on how to find them. So, man, you must have had fun putting this book together, Debbie.
It was great fun. It's actually a rewrite or a revision of the book that Mike and John originally wrote back in 1998. And so we had a lot of fun getting it up to date with a lot of the new varieties that have come on the market in the last 10 years.
And Mike, there's been a lot of change in the last 10, 20 years.
There's a lot of change from year to year nowadays. It is a little bit of a challenge, I say, for even those of us that are in the industry to kind of keep up with all the new stuff, which of course is what interests people. But you know, you do have to kind of filter through some of that, and some's good, some's bad. And part of the reason for the revision on the text was to hopefully help answer some of those questions for people and point them in the directions of some of the better, new, more recent release things.
Well, it's really a pleasure to go through the book because it's so easy to follow. And maybe you could talk about how you've got each chapter organized. It's really great.
Well, you know, I have to back up and say the concept for this book goes probably back at least 15 plus years, and it's really our co-author's concept, John Whitman. It was really his brainchild to do this, and I was fortunate enough to early on, and when he asked me to become part of it. But I will say this about the book: it is really, and to date, yet today, it's true. There is no other perennial text out there written in the fashion that this one is written, where all of the information you could want about a given a genus or group of plants is there contained probably within the matter, depending upon the size of the group, within the matter of anywhere maybe from 4 to 10 pages, and that includes everything about how to grow the plants, the background about the plant, how to grow it, how to care for it,
where to grow it.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff, plus varieties, and it's all right there in one concise little package. So if you want to read about balloon flower, you can read all about balloon flower in the matter of a few pages and hopefully get your answers.
And also see some nice color photos.
Yeah, there are some in there, and part of the revision also was to update some of the images in the book and along with some of the information as well. So there are some new images in the new text as well.
And Debbie, it's just the book hasn't been out that long.
Couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I haven't even seen it yet. I'm picking up my copy tonight. So it's really new.
And here I was going to ask you what was on page 272, and you're not going to be able to answer me.
No, I'll let Mike answer those specifics. I got the old version in front of my face, but not the new one yet. So I'm pretty excited to see it tonight myself.
Oh, well, for this part of the country, Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and other states, the perennials are wonderful.
Oh, they certainly are, and I think that the thing that people always have to remember about perennials is I think there has been for a long time, there's this little bit of a misnomer that if it's, and especially with novice gardeners, that if it's a perennial, it's going to live forever.
No.
It may or may not, depending upon perennial. Some perennials by nature are short-term plants. I mean, technically a perennial is any plant that lives longer than 3 years. So if it survives 3 years, it's considered a perennial. A perennial can be woody. It can be herbaceous. And so some are fairly short-lived. Some are much longer-lived. And the book, again, contains some information about expected longevity on specific perennials. So if you're trying to select plants for your garden based upon minimal maintenance, having to do the least amount with them. If you select carefully, you can select some plants that by nature are very long-term plants, minimal care plants, and you're not going to have to do as much with them. But again, it's all about doing your homework and understanding plants' individual needs.
Well, we have lots of callers online to visit with you. In fact, every one of my lines is filled. So let's try it out here. Let's go to Mary in Whitewater. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have some questions and concerns about hardy kiwi and arctic kiwi. And I've been growing them for a while, at least 4 or 5 years. They were ordered from a mail order house because I've never seen them in, local garden centers. And I started with five of them, and two died, and I have three left. And they are the hardy. What is the difference between the Arctic Beauty and the hardy? That's my first question. And then I pruned my hardy kiwis about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they had just taken over the fence, and they even strangle each other. The tendrils wind and wind and wind and go into my other plants and shrubs. So I pruned them drastically, but I think they're going to do the same thing, once they take off again.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I can't tell. I know I have a female, at least one female, because of the blossoms, but then they never go into fruit yet. So I'm going to guess that maybe I don't have a male left, and I can't tell the difference in their sex.
Mm.
Debbie, you want to take a stab at that one?
Yeah, actually, I'd be happy to. Can you say again, you have Arctic Beauty?
I do not have the Arctic Beauty because I don't recognize, those colored leaves.
Sure. Okay.
Sure, well, I had ordered the hardy.
Okay, well, actually, you probably need to get your hands on an Arctic Beauty because that's the male selection that you want to get that will go along with your female so you can get some fruit. And it's out there. We grow it here at Bailey, so it should be actually in some local garden centers. And these are vigorous plants and easily can get to 20 or 25 feet of vining vines on them. So you have to really give them a lot of room, either really a big arbor or arch or whatever. But once you get the male in the mix, you really only probably need one male to 4 or 5 females, you should start getting fruit, although it's not like the kiwi that you buy at the grocery store.
Yes,
it's a smaller fruit.
Yeah.
But once you get it, it's still edible fruit.
Are the fruit from the Arctic and the hardy similar? In the pictures, they show, they look a little different, but they're both supposed to be about an inch in size, and I was wondering if they have the same flavor.
I don't have the answer to that question. I've not had a chance to go up and pick fruit off of the hardy kiwis. I don't have room for those in my garden myself, and I've never seen any mature ones around here. I suspect
okay.
They're fairly similar flavor.
You'd guess.
Yeah.
You'd guess that.
Yes.
Maybe someone else, we have lots of listeners, Mary, so stay listening because I would be willing to bet somebody will call and have tried it, and we'll have an answer for you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Frank in Cedarburg, we're on to you. Hi, Frank.
Hi. have a question before I die. I'd like to learn, how do you start or germinate the daylily seeds?
From seed. So daylilies from seed.
Daylily.
Mm-hmm.
How do you start them?
Oh, they're pretty, they're actually pretty easy to, they're actually one of the easier ones to grow from seed. If you collect a seed pod, if you look at a seed pod on a daylily, you'll notice that it's a three chambered ovary that's on that, and so you'll see seeds in all three chambers of that. So when you want to, you know, you should harvest those seeds as soon as they're ripe. So and you'll be able to tell that by when they'll be brown at maturity. So so you harvest them as soon as they're ripe. So that's going to be the latter part of summer. And then what you want to do is put them in a plastic bag with some something like some barely damp, just really barely damp peat moss.
Okay.
And put them in, they need to be in a cool spot for about 8 weeks. So
okay.
Throw them in the crisper of your refrigerator or something like that.
Will do.
Or if you don't want to do that, go through that procedure. The other possibility, if you want to just direct sow them outside into a prepared seed bed, you can do that as soon as they're mature. Have your seed bed prepped and ready to go, and direct sow them outside. They, however, will not germinate till the following spring if you direct sow them outside.
Okay.
Whereas if you collect them and give them the cold treatment in the refrigerator for 8 weeks, then you can sow after the 8 week period. You can sow them into a seed tray indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And start them indoors and grow them under lights or something in the wintertime. I guess it depends upon whether you have a light setup or a place that's adequate to grow the seedlings.
Yeah, I have a light setup.
Yeah.
So I've been trying for years, but no results.
That cold treatment is pretty crucial here. They need, you know, they either need to have that cold treatment provided by nature, if you direct sow outdoors, or artificially by putting them into the refrigerator. So,
so
if you do that, you should get germination. I think the thing you have to remember with daylilies also is that germination tends to be pretty erratic on those when you grow them from seed. In other words, it can take anywhere from 2 weeks probably to almost up to 2 months for some to germinate. So they're not going to come real quickly. You have to be patient with them, and you will probably see some germination over a matter of weeks. Some will probably come early, some will come much later. But you do need to be patient with them. Once you put them into the seed tray, it'll take a few weeks for them to show up and come up. So I think if you do that, you should, if you give them that cold treatment and do that, you should do okay with them.
All right. Frank, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
We're talking about growing perennials in cold climates. That's the title of the book, with two of the three authors, Mike Hager, who owns Ambergate Gardens near Chaska, Minnesota, and Debbie Lani, who has worked professionally with plants and gardening for over 30 years. She works with Bailey Nurseries in Newport, Minnesota, near the Twin Cities. So it's great to have them with us, and thank you for listening. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for listening in today on the Ideas Network on this edition of Garden Talk. Mike Hager and Debbie Lani are guests today, authors of Growing Perennials in Cold Climates, a wonderful book. Glad to have them along. And we had an email from Glenn in Milwaukee who would like to know if granular weed deterrent will harm perennials. What do you think, Debbie?
I think if it's the right granular weed deterrent, like preen or one of the pre-emergents, as long as you follow the label directions and use the right amount, it's actually not going to hurt most perennials.
All right, there we go. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, it's on to you now. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, you guys. Glad to hear you on a Friday morning. I wanted to see if your experts would express an opinion a little bit about the genus Epimedium. See if I can't lobby a little bit before they give their answer by saying I'm in one of our production houses with 43,000 plants, and the newest plants we're dealing with are from China, a solid zone 3. I'd like to hear what your experts have to say.
Well, Mike, can I take this? Because I know Phil.
Yep.
Ah.
Hi, Phil, you little devil, you.
Good morning, Debbie.
I'll bet Mike and I would both say we love epimediums.
Absolutely.
They are beautiful plants. They are not the easiest things, though, to propagate and grow, especially in the nursery situation where I work at the big nursery. But as a shade-tolerant ground cover, it's a fabulous plant. Mike, what do you think about epimediums?
Well, the other thing I love about that plant is that it also is a shade perennial that takes a reasonable amount of drier situations as well. I mean, established plants are remarkably tolerant of dry shade, so certainly probably not their ideal growing condition, but they're really pretty tough, you know. Most of them for us in this area, I think most of them are pretty herbaceous in nature. Sometimes we get some of the foliage to overwinter, a winter like last winter where we went under snow on the, I think, the 13th of November and just lost it not too long ago.
Yeah.
We're going to see good foliage preservation. But even if they aren't evergreen, you know, you just cut them off and they send a new mound of fresh mound of growth and wonderful flowers in the month of May. They're spectacular plants. I love them.
All right. Well, there you go, Phil. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Becky and Ryo, on to you now. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I've been trying to grow monk's hood or aconitum, and I don't know the specific variety. It's just a medium lavender. When I first got it, I didn't know anything about it. I had it out in a sunny location, and it didn't do real well. So I moved it into my shade garden with the hostas and things, and it's underneath maple trees. And it seems to be growing fine, but I've read that it's supposed to bloom in July or August. Mine doesn't even send up seed stalks until September. I'm lucky if I get any blossoms before it freezes. Is that too much shade for it?
Well, to me, the ideal situation for that plant is really light shade. Now, this far north, these northern latitudes, you can actually grow them quite successfully in highlight situations as long as they're not drought stressed. They like that real highly organic, evenly moist kind of soil during the growing season. So, but I think the ideal situation is probably in light shade. Now, I expect the issue, and Debbie, you can chime in on this as well, but I expect the issue relative to your bloom time is a varietal issue. There are some monk's hoods that bloom early and some that bloom very late. And, there are actually some summer flowering species that grow very, very well, even some interesting yellow-flowered ones that bloom in the summer that we can grow here in the north. So I expect that, I'm not sure what variety you have, but I expect that you have one that is quite late to bloom for us here. And some of those in the far north, given our shortness of our seasons, sometimes don't get a chance to produce a really good show of flowers. So it may be that you have to switch varieties here as well. So, Debbie, you have some thoughts on that?
I would have said the same exact thing, Mike. Although, you know, under a maple tree, if it's really dense shade, that's probably making it harder to bloom as well.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think I'm going to move it to a lighter location, but one that's more moist, and we'll see what happens.
I think you'll have good results if you try that.
Yep.
Thanks.
Thanks, Becky, for calling. Appreciate it. And Michelle in Arcadia. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. I have been trying to grow bleeding heart in my perennial garden for many years. I'm in zone 4. And I'll get a plant from a nursery in this area that should work. And it may make it through one winter, maybe two, but not much success. And I see people in this area with these big, beautiful bleeding hearts. What can I do or what kind of a plant do I need to get that might make me a little more successful?
Debbie, you have at it with that one.
Oh, wow. Well, I don't think it's the kind of plant you're getting. I think it's probably either site location or soil. And so when you do buy a bleeding heart, it needs to go in a shady spot in the garden, maybe not the deepest, darkest, shadiest spot, but it's a shade plant, so you don't want the full sun blaring on it all summer long. And I'm going to ask you, what's your soil like? Is it sandy? Is it clay? Does it drain well?
It's a heavier soil, Fayette loam. It drains fairly well. It's in a retaining wall, actually, up and back and up again. It's a perennial garden. I put it in the shady end, so so it doesn't get a lot of sun.
Hmm.
So which type of bleeding heart have you been trying to grow? Can I ask that? Is it the standard old-fashioned variety?
The big one, yeah, the kind of standard okay. old-fashioned okay. one.
Huh. That's usually pretty tough. Like I say, I think what Debbie said is probably true. There's probably something related culturally to that site or those growing conditions. It's just not to its liking because usually that's a pretty tough, dependable plant. And so, you know, you may want to try a little bit different planting location, maybe do work on some soil amendment issues, bring your organic matter up a little bit in the soil. That might help you as well.
All right. There you go. Good luck, Michelle.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. That was a tough one. Sometimes it's tough to analyze that without a good look at the site and
exactly.
and maybe some a soil test result.
Right.
Oliver in Lancaster, we're on to you now. Hi, Oliver.
Hello. I have an old split rail fence in my backyard. And some years ago, I put some wildflower seed in there, just scattered it in, and some of that came up. It took a long time for that to germinate. But I've been thinking of some hollyhocks in there. And I was looking for some advice in regard to where could you get hollyhock seed or whatever.
Well, you should be able to get hollyhock seed on almost any seed rack, whether it's at the garden center or the home improvement store or through any of the bigger mail order seed houses. And you'll be able to buy hollyhocks with single flowers, with double flowers, short ones, tall ones. There's a lot to choose from. And what you need to remember with most hollyhocks is that they are biennial, so they have a two-year life cycle. The first year, they grow vegetatively, so you see that nice kind of tuft of foliage there. They overwinter, they come up the next year, they bloom. They set seed. A lot of times that seed drifts down into your garden, starts the cycle all over again.
I see.
So they are not true perennials.
Not true perennials, but they're pretty.
They're beautiful. Yeah. And, you know, you can get them in your yard every year. If you plant seeds 2 years in a row, let them bloom, let the seed fall down, you can have hollyhocks blooming in your yard every year. It's not too difficult.
Thanks, Oliver. Thank you for calling. You can join us, too. We finally have open lines here. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Speaking of emailing, a caller wants to know why his bearded irises bend over and break. His variety is root beer. Mike?
Well, unfortunately, that's one of the issues relative to tall bearded iris. You know, most people that are breeding modern tall bearded iris are breeding for flower color, flower size, perhaps things like ruffling and some of those kind of issues. Unfortunately, most breeders don't pay a lot of attention to stem strength. And so we get these, high bud count scapes that throw lots of large flowers, and then we get a rain or we get a heavy wind, and unless they're staked, they're very apt to go down. And you know, and there is no real solution to this other than to try to plant them in perhaps areas that are not quite not real windswept, where there's not a lot of strong winds that come through, and you may just simply have to stake them to keep them upright. It's just that, unfortunately, that's just one of the things that's been neglected in the breeding process is that stem strength, and that's just where it's at.
All right. There we go. Judy and Madison, on to you. Hi, Judy.
Yeah, I have. Last year I bought hibiscus, the perennial kind. I think it was either Lady or Lord Baltimore. And I planted it in the front of my house, which is facing south. And it just had one big long stalk on it. Now, they told me come spring to cut it down. And I'm wondering when in the spring should I cut it down now, and how far should I cut it down?
Debbie, I'll let you take that
All
one.
Right. Well, Jane, you can actually cut it down any time now. Uh-huh. I usually cut mine down to about 6 inches or so, just so I don't forget where it is, because uh-huh. the one thing you need to know about these hibiscus is their winter dormancy seems to take us through spring into early summer. You're standing over it thinking, oh, it's dead, and then it's like June 10th, and finally the buds break, and it starts to grow, and of course then it grows very quickly. So you need to be patient with your plant. I like to leave that little stump just so I don't, you know, hoe it out when I'm weeding or whatever.
Yeah.
Take it down to 6 inches. Be patient. It will be one of the last perennials in your garden to break bud, probably sometime in early June, although the way this season is going, it might be, you know, mid-June.
Uh-huh. So I can just use a lopper or something to cut the stalk?
The lopper or your hand pruner, whatever is easiest on you. It doesn't have to be any kind of an angle cut or scientific, because that whole stalk is pretty much dead.
Uh-huh.
And the new growth is going to come from the crown, from the base of that stalk.
Right.
Yeah.
And is there any diseases or pests that I have to watch out for with that?
No, not really. They're really quite clean. They're very easy to grow. It's really that whole overwintering and late budding in the spring that's probably the biggest challenge about growing a hibiscus.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well,
right.
That sounds good then.
All right.
Thanks, Judy. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And we turn to Diane in Milwaukee next. Hi, Diane.
Hi. My bleeding heart just gets so big, about 6 to 8 feet wide, and it gets all kinds of babies growing in the driveway now. In the wintertime when it's cold, I feed it potato peelings, carrot peelings, and maybe the leftover salad that's gone bad. And I think the organic matter helps it.
Huh?
Yeah, organic matter always helps, whether as a soil amendment or as a summer mulch or any of those kind of things. I mean, I think that just reiterates the importance of that for people. And it seems to me that so often that's the part that people want to put the least effort into in terms of building a garden is addressing the soil issue prior to planting, particularly if you garden on clay soils. That's such a key part and so very important for long-term success with plants. And I always tell people that, you know, if you spend the time and you spend the money to prep your soil properly in advance, you'll spend a lot less money in the long term in terms of buying plants. Now, those of us in the industry love to sell you all plants, but we also want you to be successful. And, you know, I think she just hit on it there. I mean, some of those kind of things are so key to long-term success with so many perennials. And she's right. I mean, Bleeding Heart, when it's really happy, is actually a fairly generous self-seeder. You'll find it seed itself quite prolifically around the garden, not to the point where it's a problem, but it's a fun plant.
Yeah. Thanks, Diane. Thanks very much for calling. Sue in Milwaukee, we turn to you. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks. Hollyhocks again. Oh, 6 or 7 years ago, my sister gave me some hollyhocks, which turned out to have whatever that is that gets hollyhocks. They were quite diseased. And I very stupidly threw the gallon of water that was in the bucket over the garden.
Oh.
And I'm wondering how many years before I can try growing hollyhocks again?
What do you think, Debbie?
I'm not sure. Tell me a little bit more, Sue, about this gallon of water and where it came from, because I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question totally.
She had dug up a bunch of hollyhocks from her house and stuck them in a gallon of water and then transported them down from Two Rivers down to Milwaukee. And I planted the hollyhocks and threw the water out on the garden and then found out that all the hollyhocks were really badly infected, and I've spent years digging up infected hollyhocks. But I'm wondering, it's been a couple of years now since I've gotten any hollyhock plants to dig up, and is it any chance that this fungus is out?
That it's left your soil?
Yeah.
Boy, we would have to probably talk to a disease expert to see if it's something that's going to lay dormant in the soil for a long time or not. You could certainly germinate some seed there and in one season find out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Or if there's another place in your garden that's just completely the other side of the yard or, you know, another sunny space where you could grow hollyhocks that are away from the old plants as well as where you put that water, that maybe is the better tactic, is just move away from that spot, try to find something else tall that you would like there, and put your hollyhock somewhere else in the garden.
And if you get some disease, or if it looks like you're getting some disease issue, you certainly should, you can send a sample into the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And Brian Huddleston, who is often on the program, they call him Dr. Death, because he deals with plant death a lot, but he's a great analyst, and he can take a look at it and give you his opinion. And, you know, that's after he's had a chance to look under the microscope and to really analyze it for you. So the University of Wisconsin Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, that's write that down, and you put that in the computer, and that'll pop up, and you can get a hold of Brian and send a sample if something like that happens again. Good luck. Thank you so much, Sue, for calling. Linda in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Linda.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. I have some wild ginger in a berm that I have. I planted it in with some Virginia bluebells, and it's really taking over, and I'm wondering if that would compete too much with the bluebells, or should I dig it out, or can you ever dig it out?
I'm having a hard time hearing that question. Debbie, did you hear it better than I did?
I did.
I'll let you take it then.
I can answer, Mike. Actually, Linda, wild ginger, I mean, you can dig some out if you want to control it, but in many cases, what you're describing is exactly what we want that plant to do, is to continue to colonize or grow and form a mat or a nice ground cover and work its way in and amongst other plants. So it's doing what it's supposed to. You obviously have it placed in the right situation when it comes to sunlight and fertility, and you've got it mixed with other things. If you feel like it's taken over the world, you could even get in there right now and start digging out chunks of it to control how far it's going to move throughout your garden.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Roxanne in Green Bay. She heard that delphinium and hollyhocks can't be grown close to each other because the hollyhocks will kill the delphinium. You ever hear of that?
I haven't.
I haven't either. Mike and I, let's see, we have about 60, 70 years of experience, and we haven't heard of that.
All right, well.
There are some disease issues, obviously, with both of those, but there's not a lot of crossover in terms of disease issues there between the two. So, I wouldn't have any hesitancy about growing the two side by side. I've seen them growing side by side, and they're doing fine. So
okay.
Yeah.
All right. And we're going to go to Lily next. By the way, you can join in. We have some open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Lily in Ironwood, Michigan, up next. Hi, Lily.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some beautiful green hydrangeas in my backyard, and there was a small fence that was removed by the neighbor, and it seems like the deer have eaten them ever since then, and we've never gotten any flowers. So I was thinking of transplanting them, and I was curious what the best time of year would be to do that and what kind of conditions they like, and if there's any other tips for growing hydrangeas that you could give me. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
I'm having some difficulty hearing these questions on my line here, so I don't know, Debbie, if you heard that one better than I did again or not.
I did, and I'll take it, Mike. She was questioning what time of year would be good to transplant hydrangeas.
Okay.
And, Lily, that would be actually right about now when they're dormant, and you didn't say what kind of hydrangeas you had, so there are the Annabelle types, there are the Panicle types of hydrangeas. Those are the ones that bloom later in the summer. And there are even the macrophylla types, like the endless summer hydrangea. And I think if you get at them right now while they are dormant, that would be the ideal time to get them transplanted and moved to a different spot in the garden. So go for it now. Depending on how large they are, you'll probably want to dig them up and try to kind of dig a ball of soil around the roots. Have the hole ready. Move the plant over. Transplant it in. Make sure you water it in well. You may want to prune the plant back a little bit to compensate for any root loss. Perhaps use a little bit of rooting stimulator type of fertilizer. And if you get it done here in April, you should have good success with transplanting hydrangeas.
And in any particular location?
Well, it depends on the type, Larry. The macrophylla type, like Endless Summer, and even the Annabelles are best grown in the partial shade areas like east-facing foundations. The panicle types, the PG types of hydrangeas, those are full sun-loving plants. So they need to go somewhere where you get a minimum of 6 to 8 hours of direct sunlight every day. So first thing Lily needs to know is what kind of hydrangea she has, and that will tell her what area of the garden to move it to.
Okay. Well, let's try Troy in Verona, Wisconsin. Hi, Troy.
Hi there. So I've got a yucca plant that my grandmother probably put in, 15, 20 years back. I've got a vegetable garden at the same location, and I'm scared to move it. The yucca hasn't actually blossomed the last 3 years, but it's a really healthy plant, and I'm wondering, first, how to move it, but also, you know, if I decide not to, is there anything I can do to get it to start blossoming again?
Well, they notoriously are sometimes a little bit balky in between blooms. I mean, so I don't typically think of yuccas as something that's particularly on the younger side. They're going to give me real regular bloom from year to year. Sometimes our winters, difficult winters, play a role in that as well. So I think part of the answer to that is this, it's kind of the nature of the plant. And in terms of moving one, they do have a rather large, extensive, fleshy root system, but they're not particularly difficult to move. You will find that if you do move it, that any pieces of root of the original plant that stay there, you're probably going to get some young yucca plants sprouting up off of those roots. They do have adventitious buds on their roots, and so it's not uncommon if you leave a little piece of root in there, not a little, I mean, you know, the sizable piece of root in there, that you'll see some young plants come from that as well. But, you know, but I think you'll want to take a fairly large clump of soil with it, because they do have, as I say, a fairly extensive fleshy root system on them, but they certainly can be moved. They're not that difficult.
All right.
Okay, and the other question I have also with the yucca is that for winterizing it, I haven't done anything. Is the best thing to do is just wrap that thing with hay or leaves so it's got a little bit of cushion for the winter?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, they're evergreen plants, and if we don't have snow cover or some kind of protection on them, sometimes we do see rather severe winter burn on them. The green foliage can burn up pretty bad. You know, if you protect them somehow, you minimize the chance for that winter desiccation and winter burn on the foliage, and so that may be as simple as putting a shade screen on the south and west sides of it to keep the winter sun off, or throwing some evergreen boughs or something over the top of the plant to keep the winds or that kind of thing off of it as well. So certainly those kinds of steps will help to preserve that foliage. However, if you do get into a situation, and I've seen this, where a big old plant just totally burnt up, foliage just totally burnt up in the wintertime, actually what I did is just took a pruning saw to it, cut it off at the ground level, and I got a fresh new mound of foliage on it the next year. So that typically will not kill them. They will resprout from that as well.
There you
Wonderful.
Go.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We're talking with the authors of Growing Perennials in Cold Climates, wonderful new book out, and our guest, Mike Hager, who owns Ambergate Gardens near Chaska, Minnesota. It's a retail mail-order walk-in business devoted entirely to herbaceous perennial flowers. And Debbie Lani is also our guest, who's worked professionally with plants and gardening for 30 years or better, and she works with Bailey Nurseries in Newport, Minnesota, near the Twin Cities. And they, boy, don't they know? They know their stuff, don't they? It's great to have them with us. And thank you for listening here to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we visit with Mike Hager and Debbie Lani about growing perennials in cold climates. Mike, the book's only been out, but are you seeing some pretty good interest in it?
Well, I was involved with the first round of this, and the book is the original book has been out of print for well over 2 years, and And the question constantly being asked was, when's the book coming back? When's the book coming back? Well, and there were some trials and tribulations in the publishing world to work through on that, but they've been worked through, and so it is, you know, as I say, just been re-released here as of April 1st in a revised format, and so far, yeah, people are pretty excited the book is back.
Yeah, it's I can see why, and I'm predicting a bestseller status for it too, because it's really packed with great information. Jim in Viroqua, we're on to you now. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm building a house in the Viroqua area, heavy clay soils and rock. And as usually happens, the well went in first, and now I'm building a house, and the well's going to end up right smack in the middle of the front yard. And I know nothing about perennials, but I'm looking for some suggestions on what perennials could you plant to kind of hide a two-foot-tall well head right in your front yard. And it's mostly clay soil, but it's been backfilled with some sand around it. And I know nothing about perennials, so I'll just take an answer off the air and write down your suggestions. Thank you.
Well, maybe Debbie and I will both take a stab at that.
Sure.
And the first group that immediately comes to my mind perhaps would be some of the ornamental grasses, you know, both perhaps native or grasses from other parts of the world. You know, they work so effectively for screening, you know, things like wellheads and telephone connections and electrical boxes and things like that. You know, they are, however, kind of seasonal. So, I mean, if you want something that's going to screen that year-round, then you may end up going more into the realm of a woody plant, evergreen kind of woody plant that would give some, you know, help hide that through all four seasons of the year. But to me, the first group of things that I say would grow to in the perennial world would perhaps be the grasses. So I don't know. Debbie, what do you think?
I think that's a great idea, Mike. I can't think of any other group of perennials that would be a better screening plant than a grass. But, you know, that you could put in a small garden there around that well area, especially with things that are shallow rooted. And if it's a mix of perennials and woody plants, you know, that looks great. Perennials are not just for gardens all by themselves, and they can be mixed with other types of plants, woody plants, evergreens, roses, shrubs, and even annual flowers as well. So you could have a lot of fun putting a lot of things in there to, you know, hide that well head.
Absolutely. And thanks again for calling. Ellen in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there. Hi. I have, oh, I'm going to go back to hollyhocks, which I, you know, they just grow in abundance, you know. I had a few hollyhocks. I threw seeds here. I threw seeds there. But last summer, I had this horrible, well, I keep seeding from, I keep the pods. I give them to people, you know. I give them, when the seeds are nice and ready, I just say throw them on the ground, and guess what? They grow everywhere. But rust, some kind of a rusty, thing just annihilated my leaves last year going into the stalks. They flowered real nice, but boy, the rest of it looked just ugly.
And, of course, that's the primary disease issue with that group of plants is a fungal rust disease. And when it's severe, you know, it does a good job. A lot of that is tied to weather conditions, as many fungal outbreaks are. You know, they're very definitely tied to environmental conditions, and they're going to be worse in some years than the other. I think one of the things to key long-term to growing those hollyhocks successfully is when you do run into a situation like that where you've had a severe disease outbreak, the spores overwinter on last year's foliage and stems and that kind of thing. So sanitation in terms of cleaning out last year's plant debris and eliminating it from the garden is going to be key towards reducing inoculum down the line. So if you clean up well, you destroy all that, get it out of there, you're going to have much less potential for a severe disease outbreak again. Not to say that it's not going to happen, but it's certainly going to help minimize that. So the sanitation part of that is very, very important. So, Debbie, you have some thoughts on that?
I think that you hit the nail on the head, Mike.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing for you to do.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Bet you guys didn't realize you were going to get so many hollyhock questions.
Popular group of plants.
No, nobody's asked about a hosta or few of the other bigger groups. So.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they got those all nailed down. They're, you know, it's a pretty smart audience. A lot of good gardeners listening in here. Oh, man. Ann in Stevens Point, we're on to you. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I realized as I was holding that my question is actually about what I consider a shrub, so I hope that qualifies in the conversation. I have a nice cheeky willow, and I just love it. I've found a good location for it after two tries, and it's growing really well, but I've kind of neglected the pruning on it, and so now I'm a little concerned. It's taller than it should be, and I'm wondering if you know if that's something that I can prune back hard and not damage it too much. I feel like I've missed my chance. It's already budding out, so I assume it's too late for this year to do it, but I guess I just need advice.
Well, Ann, what kind of willow did you say it was?
I believe it's called Nishiki.
Ah, Nishiki. Okay, okay. Well, seeing as I have to tell you that this perennial book is part of a series, and the next one coming out is called Growing Small Trees and Shrubs in Cold Climates, and
I helped
John with that one.
Cool.
We'll talk about shrubs. Nishiki willow it's something, Ann, you need to get in the habit every year of doing some pruning on that plant.
Yeah.
That plant will get out of hand and get to 14 feet tall if you let it and lose all the variegation in the process. But it's not too late to prune it now. And here's what you need to do is you need to look at the plant and maybe prune out 25 to 30% of the thickest stems right at the base. So go in with a lopping shear or a pruner if they're not too big and thin it out a little bit. And what that's going to do is it's going to encourage young stems to come up from the base. And it's those young, thin stems that have the best variegated foliage. But then I want you to kind of prune it back from the top a little bit. You can cut it back a little bit, shape it up a little bit. Not that you need to make a perfect round ball, but you can shape it. And those two pruning techniques are going to get that plant in check, and I want you to get in the habit of doing that every spring, and it will look good.
There you go.
I did touch it because it wasn't very happy at first. But thank you very much. It's very helpful.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling, Ann. Sharon in Belmont, hello to you.
Hello. I don't want to talk about hollyhocks.
Yay!
We have a front yard that has where the rocks were placed and the whatever they dug out for our house, and we've never been able to do anything with it. The weeds have grown there, and this year it looks like we might be close now to planting some plants in there. Like it would have to be like rock garden plants. And I heard you talking about the wild ginger. I wondered if that would work in there.
What do you think, Debbie?
Well, Sharon, is it sunny there?
Is it what?
Sunny.
All sunny.
All
except,
sunny.
I mean, in the afternoon, the house is there to shade the morning sun.
And does the soil drain well?
Oh, yes. It's all slanted.
Okay. Well, the wild ginger is more for the shadier sites. So you're going to have to look for some more of the rock garden type of perennials that are going to take the full sun, take the heat, take that rocky soil. And there are, you know, things like dianthus, which are in the carnation family, sedums. You know, there are a lot of things that you can choose. I would save the wild ginger for the shadier part of the garden.
All right.
Mike, do you have any suggestions? I know you can come up with way more rock garden plants than me on the fly.
Well, yeah, actually my orientation was maybe a little bit odd. The other thing to consider with this, perhaps it might be some of the native prairie species, that particularly the goat prairie species that are native on dry, sunny prairie sites, things like all purple smoke and passflower and little blue stem and blue grama grass and some of those kind of things. So I think there may be an opportunity there to incorporate some of the native species into that planting as well. And that doesn't mean it has to be native only. You can mix natives with some of the things Debbie talked about, like dianthus and sedums, and those things can mix beautifully together. But I think the key is to select types of perennials that are going to love it hot, love it dry, and that kind of soil. And those are all things we've talked about, are all things that are going to do well in that situation.
Yep, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And I think you mentioned it earlier, one of the things I like about your book, too, is that you give locations and places where people can order the proper flowers, perennials.
Yeah, I mean, there's with each plant group, there are some suggested sources to where people can go, perhaps, to look for some of these. And the other key thing with that, I always tell people, when they're looking for sources for specific plants, there's a great web resource out of Minnesota here, if you don't mind, I'll give the web address. If you go to www.plantinfo, all one word, plantinfo.umn, as in University of Minnesota, .edu. You go to that site, there's a search function that you can type a plant's name into there on that site. Type the plant's name in, press your return key, and it'll immediately give you a listing
of the information you need. And we can talk some more about that. Our guests today, Mike Hager and Debbie Lonnie, authors of Growing Perennials in Cold Climates. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mealer here, really pleased to have with me today by phone, two of the three authors, Mike Hager and Debbie Lonnie. The other author, John Whitman, isn't with us, but Mike and Debbie are. They are the authors of Growing Perennials in Cold Climates. It's a wonderful book, and they're great guests. They have lots of wonderful answers for you when it comes to your perennials, and I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Please join in. And I want to go back. Well, actually, first, a caller wants to know where to buy the book. We have it linked on my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. But, Mike, do you want to? I think probably any bookstore. Go to the local bookstore, order it online, I would guess.
I mean, I think it'll be widely available through local bookstores, and of course is on Amazon. It's available from all the authors. It's going to be quite easy to find. You can purchase it directly through the University of Minnesota Press's website, which the University of Minnesota Press is the publisher on this edition as well. So, I mean, there are a number of avenues. You shouldn't have too much difficulty finding it.
All right, wonderful. We have more callers online. Let's go to Frances in Muskego next. Hi, Frances.
Hi. I've got a question about the showy lady slipper, or else the orchid. It's called an orchid lady slipper, the one that's got that big little pot, big fat little belly on the bottom, like a little pot. Do you know anything about that? I've tried to grow it for a couple of years, and I know the slugs love it, so that I've got licked, but I don't know what kind of soil I should be putting it in or what to do with it.
Well, the thing you have to remember with most of all of those native orchids and lady slippers being included is that they do depend upon a very specific relationship with a fungus in the soil in order to grow them long term. And so that often is somewhat difficult to achieve in a cultivated landscape. And so a lot of times those tend to be fairly short term plants because that it's called a mycorrhizal fungus that lives in a symbiotic relationship with the plant's root system. If that is not there, they're just not going to be long-term plants. And I honestly think that in the long term, most of those plants are probably best left and best enjoyed in the wild situations, except perhaps for native yellow lady slipper, which is a far easier plant to grow. But most of the others are really pretty difficult.
Well, what's the secret with the yellow one? Is that just that's the one I'm trying to
grow? Oh, you're trying the yellow one. Okay.
I'm trying to grow that pink one. I'm sorry, the yellow one.
Yeah, the pink one's just really, there are a number of different pink ones, but they're just really difficult. The native yellow lady slippers, and of course there are two forms of that, a large flowered form and a small flowered form of it. They're both relatively easy plants to grow in a woodland kind of situation. So where you know, a situation where our native wildflowers occur, you can take yellow lady slippers and put them into that situation, high humus content in the soil, and they're far more forgiving. And so I'm not sure exactly what's been going on there in your situation, but if you can grow it in a space where you can grow things like trillium or native ginger or those kind of things, you should be able to grow the yellow lady slipper with not too much difficulty.
And, you know, another real quickie, what do you do about deer?
Deer. You don't have any deer in Minnesota, do you?
Well, you know, we all struggle with deer problems up here in the upper Midwest, but I always tell people it's nothing here compared to what it is on the East Coast. They really have serious deer problems. So, you know, and Debbie, you might want to chime in as part of this as well. I'll just make a couple of quick comments here relative to the deer situation. What you have to understand, two primary things, that one, they're creatures of habit. So if you can interrupt that their habits somehow, you may have some success in deterring feeding. The other thing is that if the feeding pressure is great enough, in other words, if the population level is high enough, there are enough deer and there's not enough food, they're going to eat virtually anything. Now, some plants are less prone to being eaten by deer than others, but if there's enough of them, it's a really, really difficult situation. So. Debbie, yeah. You have some thoughts?
I think, no. My thought is get a gun.
Sure.
And if we could come up with a way to keep deer out of garden, we'd be wealthy beyond our wildest dreams.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think just one other quick thing relative to that. If you are going to depend on some type of deterrent, some way of trying to deter them from feeding, don't depend on one product solely. You have to go through a rotation of products because the deer will habituate to whatever that deterrent is. So you're always trying to stay one step ahead of them. So you do have to rotate for long-term success.
There you go, Francis. Thanks for calling. Sometimes a dog helps.
It can be very helpful, actually.
Yes.
Tina in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, I'm trying to grow attract some monarch butterflies, and I just ordered some milkweed, and I'm just wondering how well that will do and if they have any tips to keep them going.
Debbie, I'll let you go after that one.
Well, did you order seed or plant?
Seedlings, I think.
Okay.
They haven't arrived yet.
Well, you've picked a good plant to bring in some monarchs, and they are not that difficult to grow. But they do like the more moist soil situations, or don't put them somewhere where they're going to dry down. They're not going to do very well there.
Okay.
That would be my best advice on the milkweed.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Mo in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi.
Hi there. I purchased 5 reed grasses 2 seasons ago, and time ran out, and I just stuck them in the ground in the fall. Wrong place, too close. Now, finally, I realize I got to move them. Can I? How do I do it? How deep do I have to go? You know, I obviously want to, I will keep 2 there and move 3. So how big of a clumps do I have to go out? How deep?
They're actually very easy grasses to move around. And, if you just take that grass with a good shovel full of soil and you'll put it where you want it. They're very forgiving and very easy to do. Now, reed grasses, of course, are cool season grasses. So if you have a reed grass, it's probably up and going already. You probably got growth on it.
Cut it back.
How tall is it now?
It's about, I'd say 10 inches.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to move that clump intact, if you're not going to, and even if you were, say, if you wanted to chop it in half at 10 inches foliage, you could probably still do it. However, you could also cut the foliage back halfway, and the grass will just simply grow back out of it again. So, but they're not difficult plants to do at all. And being a cool season grass, the best time to do them is one of two times. Ideally here in the far north, the early springtime, just when they're coming into growth, would be the best time. But you can also move them later in the season as well. So,
and then how much sun do they require?
Well, the green grasses in general are full sun to light shade plants. So, you get into medium to dense shade, you're not going to have, the grass is probably going to reach a little bit. You're not going to get particularly good flowering in that situation. Of course, you don't get good flowering, you're not going to get good seed head production as well. So I think definitely the answer to your question is you want them on the higher light end of things, but they will take light shade. Definitely will do that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Mo, you need to get out tomorrow and get it done.
Yeah.
There you go. Good weekend project.
Good weekend project. Julie, it was near Afton. We go to you next. Hi, Julie.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
I am so glad you're on. I love plants. I can't wait till this rain stops and we have some decent weather. I have a blue spruce that is we've got a turnaround on our driveway, which is cement. And it's gotten to the point where it's growing out into the driveway. We have to cut off the bottom of the spruce. First of all, when is a good time to cut a spruce of the lower branches? And two, what can they plant underneath the spruce?
Well, Julie, you can probably do that pruning any time. If you're going to go right up to the trunk and take that entire branch off at the trunk, you can go in and do it any time. What I would recommend is that you get in the habit of, the next layer of branches up, when the new growth comes on, nip them back halfway. It'll keep the plant looking full, help kind of keep it in check a little bit or keep
it. Well, I don't want to plant grass there. I want to plant some type of greenery that, kind of spreads out. And I've seen some here and there, don't know what type it is, that's been under different types of pine trees. I just don't know what the names of them are.
Well, so you want to do something perennial or ground cover, underneath that tree. Well, some pros and cons to doing that. You have the competition from the tree. And in some cases, depending on where that tree is placed and how many branches, how far up on the trunk you've gone, the light intensity will vary a little bit. It could be really deep and dark shade, but maybe on the edge, it could be really sunny. So, you're going to have to kind of assess the light situation and pick plants depending on, how far up are you going to prune those branches off the ground?
Probably about 3 feet right now. We're afraid to prune it. I'm saying about 3-4 feet.
Okay. Well, then you're probably going to get some pretty good light levels underneath that tree, and you could probably go with some of the more sun-tolerant ground covers, or that will take part sun, lamium or lamiastrum. There's any number of different things that you could put there to just cover it up, and you're going to have to kind of balance off the water needs of the tree with the water needs of the ground cover. Perhaps use some mulch there to keep the moisture in as well.
Yeah, the soil here, unfortunately, is kind of subsoil. We bought farmland 30-some years ago, and now there's a lot of trees on it, but even still, the ground gets in the summer when it starts to get hot and dry, it gets like a clay brick.
Well, and
I have to amend everything that where I have gardens.
I think the other thing that you may have to be cognizant of here, too, particularly since you're under that large tree, is you're going to have to try to select some plants that can take that drier growing conditions, be they for sun or shade. I mean, it's a couple things we talked about already on the program here today. We had the call about epimediums or barrenworts. I mean, there's a plant that, as a ground covery kind of plant under the tree would take the shade and will take the dry growing conditions. So I think you're going to have to be kind of thinking along those lines for long-term success as well.
Yeah, I agree. Mike, do you think Vinca minor would work, Val?
It would.
Well there?
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
It would take that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Elaine and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, I put in some substance hostas. I don't know the botanical name, but I put them in about maybe 4 years ago on the north side of my house. I have relatively good soil.
But like last year, two of them did not, I mean, they did great. They all were about the same size. They were huge. And last year I have two of them that are just puny, and I don't know why. The only thing I can think of is maybe there's some kind of grub or something maybe at the roots, or so I'm ready to maybe dig them up this year. My other thought was maybe they're crowded. I tend to crowd my gardens a bit.
Well, we're both hosta lovers, so maybe I'm not quite sure what's going on. I mean, a well-grown sum and substance. I saw one plant in a garden in Ohio one time that I kid you not, the foliage was almost chest high on me, and the plant was 5 feet across. So they can get to be, that plant can get to be very, very large when it's happy. I think again with in the hosta world, one of the keys to growing that plant really, really well is high organic content in the soil and water, water, water. I mean, hostas love moisture, and so I'm not sure exactly what the growing conditions are there, but I think those might be a couple things that would help maybe turn that. Debbie?
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, Lane, how far apart do you have these plants?
Well, you know, that was one thing that I thought. I didn't realize how big they were going to get, that was one thought, is maybe they are just too crowded.
Mm-hmm.
I would say maybe a yard apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty close.
It is. You may want to just take two of the four out and move them somewhere else and let those two plants have more room to get to that big size. I think that would be a good opportunity, just like Mike says, to add some organic matter to the soil, even around the surrounding plants that are there, and then make sure you water well.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Elaine. And let's go to Ann in West Bend. Hi, Ann.
Hi there. I have a problem with some of my shrubs where the rabbits did some clippings on them. I have a Catona Easter and some two small lilac bushes in which it's from the on the lilac, it's from the base of the plant about up maybe 10 inches. I'm afraid it's going to kill my lilacs. Do I cut them down to the ground, or what do I do to save the bushes?
Well, we're seeing, Anne, a ton of rodent damage after all this snow that we've had this winter. And I can't tell you for sure if your plants are going to be killed. A lot of it depends on how badly girdled the plant is. So if they've chewed off all the bark all the way around the stems, that's not a good sign.
Yeah, they did.
And you might have to, you know, a lilac could come out of that. You could actually cut a lilac down to the ground, and it will resprout, come back up, take some time to get back to its old size, but it could be saved. The Catona aster could possibly be saved as well. I mean, if it's only some of the stems, you would prune out the ones that have been chewed on by the rabbits and let the other stems go.
Okay.
So it just depends on how severe it is.
Yeah, the lilacs are the worst. They're all the way around. They really did a damage on that. It's the first time that's happened.
Well, I've seen it. I'm sitting here at my office looking out at our office gardens. I've never seen so much damage, and we're getting ready to go out and start cleaning up tomorrow, and a lot of things we've talked about, we're just going to go cut them off right at the ground level. So, you know, we know that in some cases those plants will resprout and come out. In some cases we think we're going to have some mortality and we're going to have to go in and replace the plant. So time will tell. Depends on what, you know, happens as things start to grow. If you're not seeing any new growth by the end of May, you'll probably want to replace those lilacs.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. And Tom in Wausau, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I have some beds of vinca and pachysandra in a shady north-facing backyard. And a couple years ago, the plants in areas started to develop root rot or a blight. The top of the green surface was fine, but then the roots started to rot. And I'm wondering, one, what it is and how to treat it. And my second question is how to properly mulch it. Should I mulch it with, I usually mulch it with chopped up maple leaves in the fall, or should I wait until that turns to compost, and then mulch it with compost instead of maple chopped up maple leaves.
Well, Debbie, you might be a little bit better at this. I am aware that there are some root rot issues with those plants, particularly as we go farther east in this country, I think, if I'm not mistaken. We typically don't see a whole lot of that here. Are you familiar with that problem?
No, I've not heard it. I've not seen that at all, Mike.
Yeah, I'm aware that that at times that Pakistander plant is particularly in eastern United States have some disease issues. And I think a lot of, again, is tied to weather conditions and with higher humidities and stuff. Not something that I've really come across here much in this part of the world. And so, you know, I think I don't know that either one of us can definitely answer that question for you. It may behoove you to, if that shows up again, to submit a sample to the plant disease clinic at the University of Wisconsin, and just to truly identify what's going on there, and then you can really deal with the issue in terms of how to correct it. But without knowing exactly what the pathogen is, you're kind of shooting in the dark, and that's not a really a good way to approach it. So.
Yeah. Good points.
I think, though, Tom had a question about how to mulch it, and I guess I don't, given the kind of the evergreen or semi-evergreen nature of both of those plants, I probably would not recommend putting big old maple leaves on top of them. I'd rather see you chop them up or...
Yeah, I think he was chopping them. But
yeah, letting them decompose a little bit and then getting them on so it doesn't, you know, sit too much on that foliage, especially over the winter.
And I think you got to be careful not to put too much of that on as well, because in effect, those plants are kind of self-mulching. I mean, the nature of the plant and the way they grow, they cover the ground and do some of the things that you would normally depend upon a mulch to do for you in the garden. So you don't want to put, I think, too thick a layer of any of that on as well, because that could accentuate the disease problem as well.
Sure. I agree, Mike.
There you go. Thanks, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Janet in Oak Creek, hello to you.
Hi, I just wanted to pass on a tip for the lady regarding the hostas. This worked for me. To get hostas larger, cut the flowers off, and you will find that they almost double in size.
Oh, what do you think, Debbie?
Oh, I agree with that. I'm not sure if that would have been the cause of her puny plants. But, yeah, if you cut the flowers off, less energy going into flower and seed production and more energy going into the foliage of the plant. So that's a good tip. But some people like the flowers of hostas.
Yeah, I kind of like the flowers.
Yeah.
So
the plant I was mentioning earlier that had foliage, it was chest high and was 5 feet across. The gardener there did some exceptional things in terms of his soil preparation to get the plant to that size. But the joke that always went along with that plant was that, and he literally did this, when he planted the plant, he put a raccoon underneath it as well. So.
Oh, man. Well, on that note, thanks, Janet, very much for calling. And again, I want to mention the book that our two guests today, or two of the three authors of the book, Mike Hager and Debbie Lonnie, Growing Perennials in Cold Climates. How long did it take to do this, put this book back together again?
Actually, it went pretty quick. It had to go pretty quickly from the time the publisher agreed to do it. It was just a matter of a few months to get the revision done. But the original one, actually, when John and I worked on the original book, it actually took us, you know, probably the better part of 2 years to put the original together. So, yeah.
Well, you guys are great guests. Would you come back and be with us again?
I'd love to.
Be happy to.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I'll look forward to another visit.
Thank you.
Mike Hager, who owns Ambergate Gardens near Chaska, Minnesota. Ambergate Farms is a retail mail order walk-in business devoted entirely to herbaceous perennial flowers. Debbie Lonnie has worked professionally for 30 years in gardening. She works with Bailey Nurseries in Newport, Minnesota, near the Twin Cities. And he did a wonderful job in this. You're going to have to take a look at this book. It's called Growing Perennials in Cold Climates, and it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Monday, we'll be talking craft beers and also a visit from our weather guys. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.